Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, our conversation for tonight is going to be one that is... How are we going to introduce this one without getting you riled up, without getting you in your feelings? Also, take note that today is Wednesday, and what we do on Wednesdays, we address the elephant in the room like any other day, but then it's the elephant that you address. It's the elephant that you bring onto the table. And I know that part of our callers have been really, really taking advantage of the Wednesdays, but then also because of the nature of our show, right? Because our show is a therapy session. It is a session where we are learning about our own behavior. We are learning about what's happening out there, and we are learning about how we feel, and we're just going through the motions of life, right? And some of our callers have really honestly been taking advantage of this one, which is a good thing. I love it. I love it for us because I believe in being open, and I believe in talking about the elephant in the room in your home. So I like to hear about how you're dealing with things and how you're coping and what life is for you and how did you wake up today. I love hearing about that, and I also like to be asked that question, and I like having human experiences because it's my thing. My thing is being a human being. My thing is being a human being for you, for me, for everyone, and everybody else being human beings for one another. So basically, I go home after I knock off from work, and I go and sit in my space, right? And I sit in my space, I light myself a candle, and, you know, I burn a little bit of Izimba, you know, just for control, you know, to summon my ancestors. And then I sit there and I journal and I meditate. And then I also, sometimes I program my week or I program my month, and then I put up a few things that are important to me, and we tackle it, myself and I. We tackle it and we see how many things we can achieve throughout the month or throughout the week or even just throughout the day. And that's basically my routine. Now my routine wanders off into the wee hours. My routine wanders off into nighttime. I come alive in the nighttime. My daytimes are filled with fatigue and slugging and also a dragging out of bed, you see. I'm one of those people like, oh, I've never been a morning person a day in my life. I've never ever been a morning person. I can't deal with mornings. I'm grumpy. I'm mean. I'm just not. And especially when you wake me up, right? That one is not working. And then I think also I'm coming down with something, but oh. Yeah, I'm tired of coming down with something, guys. Really, how? I'm tired of coming down with something more. But all in all, I'm going through life, you know, and I'm enjoying it, and it's ups and it's downs, and I'm yet to find a space where I can truly be in an element of some sort. And I'm looking for that space, you know. I always thought that the space in itself comes with your own terrain and your own territory. And then the territory is shared. And when the territory is shared, it is not the same as you brainstorming in the middle of the night in your room by yourself in an underwear and a big t-shirt. It's not the same, because now you have to be considerate, right? You have to be considerate of the music. If you're playing any music, you have to be considerate of the time. You have to be considerate of the hours. You have to be considerate of the people that are in your environment that has to now have early mornings, but then it could be that you might disrupt this. And this is not something that most people talk about. Nobody talks about how having children means that you sacrifice your space and your, a bit of your sanity and a bit of your, your meticulous planning. You know, it, nobody really talks about that one because it's about to be, it's always about, how amazing it is to be somebody's parent. And it's so amazing to be a mom and so amazing. Everything's so amazing, especially for those that don't have children yet and for those that are anticipating children and for those that can't have children. I think they have the same mindset of children are blessings, and they are blessings, but nobody talks about the fact that you have to give up so much in order for you to be somebody's parent, right? And also nobody talks about how much you have to give up in order for you to be somebody's partner. Now, the idea behind partnership is that we're going to do this life thing together and we're going to go through life together and we're going to try our utmost best to be the best versions of ourselves for ourselves and for one another and also for the people that we're bringing into this world that didn't ask to be brought into this world. We brought them purely out of selfish reasons of having somebody that is purely ours, right? And that is why we have children. We have children because we want to carry on our seed, and we have children because we want to be parents, and we have children because we want to fill up our homes and we want unconditional love. I believe that many of us have children because we want unconditional love, and nobody can give you unconditional love more than a child can give you unconditional love, because regardless of how bad you are, there's still an element of they will always love you, or they will always come through for you, or they will always look back for you because they are yours and you are theirs and you are their mother or you are their father, and they will always, you know. And Tate Kauluma was talking about an important element of the conversation that I also wanted to have tonight about children being raised in environments that are not conducive, and they get accustomed to the nasty that happens in these environments, and when they grow up, they tend to mimic the environments from which they came from because that is all they know and that is what they assume to be normal. We have this thing of thriving in the chaos because chaos is all we know. So if we only know chaos, then the likelihood of us sprinkling chaos in whatever amazing or abundant way we possibly can in our day-to-day lives is inevitable because it's all we know and we are living in survival mode. Hence the conversation around survival mode, right? So here we are, and I'm looking at my own life, right? Because I can't look at other people's lives when I haven't figured my own life out yet. And I can't figure out, my traumas and my personality traits and my characteristics without looking within myself, because I'm a person that constantly wants to grow, especially within the field of psychology. I don't know how I'm going to be an advocate one day. I don't know. I think I'm giving that dream up. I'm giving that dream up to go and do psychiatry. I want to be a psychiatrist. I want to, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and do psychiatry. So I believe that we need to backtrack in order for us to have a better understanding of ourselves and why we are the way we are. We need to backtrack and we need to find elements that didn't sit right. And I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about, people that had gone through traumatic experiences and people that had gone through post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, or people that have had a rough time. They often have this memory loss, right? And this memory loss is so profound that sometimes your best friend can tell you, like, oh, do you remember that other time when you came through at 2 o'clock in the night and we were just all over the place and we danced and we what? And for the life of you, you can't remember that. And I was like, I can relate. Now, how many of you guys can relate? How many of you guys can relate to not remembering most of your life? Hello.
Good evening.
I'm good, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How have you been?
Good.
Are you sure?
It's just that we are not we are still not okay about the radio station.
And you're in Arandas, right?
Sorry?
Where are you? Arandas or Swakop?
Yes.
Between the two. So you don't know where you are nicely. You're in between you're in between towns?
I'm in Swakop.
You're in Swakop. How's school going?
School is going okay. Since we are there, since we already passed the half of the year.
Did you do well?
Yeah, I did well. I passed my June exam.
Yeah?
Mm.
Are you happy for yourself?
Yeah, I am.
Why don't you sound happy?
I just woke up now.
So you sleep and then you put on an alarm for 9 o'clock. I'm going to class, guys.
I want to just say hi.
Nah? Yeah, but I wanna talk to you a little bit.
Okay.
What makes your life worth living?
I was living. The reason that I'm waking up in the morning. The reason I'm breathing each and every morning and was living it. Yeah.
What is the reason?
That I'm living.
What is the reason that makes you wake up every morning?
Oh, God.
Nah? Just yeah. God that is having us here.
God is the reason.
God is the reason. Because if it was up to me alone, how the hell? So when are you going to get into a relationship? When you're 25?
Not really.
When you're 25 months? Or 26 months?
When I'm 25 or 26. Yeah, I hope so.
Where are you going to find him? At church, Moss. You're going to find him at church, Moss. Why don't you have these answers? You're supposed to have these answers. Now I'm answering for you. How?
Oh.
Hey, so you're going to find him at church, Moss?
Yeah, maybe at church it can be a different location.
Like where? The shop?
Yeah. No, the shop.
Like where? You don't go anywhere. So, like, this guy, imagine at work or what? You're going to find him at work. He's going to be a client.
Yeah, maybe at work.
Oh,
a church.
Yeah? Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
In Canada.
What's that? You are going to Canada?
Yeah.
To go and do what?
Yeah, to work there.
What are you going to work?
Like to be a teacher. Yeah, I'm just wishing. I just want to be in Canada.
Yeah, you just want to go.
Just want to go.
Why?
Maybe for 1 or 2 years. And then I'm back again.
To come and do what here?
Not to work.
Then why don't you just work there forever or work here forever?
Forever, man? I will see the coming years.
If you had a magic wand and you could fast forward, where would you land? If you could fast forward your life, where would you land?
Like a place or what?
a place, an age, a time in your life, where would you be if you had that kind of power to say that, you know what, simsalabam, alakazam, bam, I'm 30 years old, I'm white, and this is my reality. Where would that be?
I really don't have any idea, but let me see. Because I really don't grow up so quickly just like that. So maybe within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be turning 24.
Mm-hmm.
Like just that moment that I'm graduating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done with my course and I'm graduating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I will take myself there.
Mm-hmm. And then you didn't have to learn anything. Ah. Yeah, just wake up at Safari. With a graduation gown and a face beat.
And then I get my paper and then level one.
Who are you going to look back at and who are you going to assist?
Orphans.
You're going to assist orphans? And the people that took care of you, you're not going to assist. You're going to assist outside people. Orphans.
I'm also going to assist them. They need help, also can help.
What makes you happy? You can't say God.
I can say
it. You can't say God. I know that you are also going to say God makes me happy. Ha! Another thing.
Except God.
Because obviously, yes. He's number one. Number two?
When I'm doing good in school.
Okay, so when you're done with school and you don't no longer have school, you will not have anything that makes you happy. So you'll just be a sad person.
In between, I'll just be there. From God and then...
What made you turn to God?
What made me repent, maybe?
Yeah, what made you repent?
I just realized that without God in this world, I can't.
Is it because you didn't have God before? Or you didn't have God in the way that you wanted to have him?
Yeah, I didn't have God the way he wants me to be. I was living otherwise. But then since I encounter with him, everything changed.
Everything changed and everything is smoother?
I feel like someone that is living on earth.
Before, where were you?
I don't know where I was, but...
In space. That's nice. And you're happy?
Yes, I'm happy. I'm happy.
What happens if one day you finally get to the point where you're supposed to meet God and then there's no God? But I cannot imagine that. No, he's there.
He is there.
Mm.
Yes, he is there. His word is assuring us that he is there. It's not like he is not there, but he is really there.
Now, what if you find this boyfriend of yours in the church, and you guys caught in the church, and everything is nice, you guys get married, and then this guy just decides to do other things, and then just turns your whole life around?
Well, we are married
already. Yeah, my dear. We are already inside. Well, you cannot just break up and go home.
I don't think you will turn.
But if he does?
If he does? No, we are going to pray about it.
What's that? Prayer warrior. The Bible squad.
We are going to pray about it.
Going to pray about it. Is that okay? Today, basically, I'm talking about, are we bullying ourselves? You know, mentally, are we bullying ourselves? So that's why I'm asking you all these questions. That's why I asked, are you happy? You said, yes, you are. You know, what will you do in the future? So I think that, so I'm saying that, basically we're talking about, bullying ourselves and what does that do to us? Have you ever lost anybody, like, to death?
Yes.
Who?
One of my uncles.
One of your uncles? You're so innocent, it's so sweet. Maybe you're like a young freak outside there, but to me you're so innocent, it's a breath of fresh air. You lost one of your uncles. Was he your favorite?
Yeah, he was my favorite. Yes, he used to have it with
Tomoki. Okay. How many friends do you have?
I'm finding it difficult to make friends.
Why?
I don't know. Like, really, I don't know why I'm finding it difficult. But for now, there's no friend,
Why do you think you're finding it difficult? Maybe because your friend is a big auntie at the radio station. The things that you guys talk about with your old friend. It's not the things that the other young people talk about. Maybe that's the problem. People want to talk crop top things and you are going to school with your long skirt. But why do you think you're finding it difficult? Are you judgmental?
Not really,
just a little bit.
It's just bad. I don't trust people easily. Like,
why?
If you become my friend, I'll be like, I'll be that open with you and I'll tell you everything. And then maybe after 2 or 3 days, if you disappoint me, I don't know what I will do.
Now, what secret things do you have that you, apparently it would be such a big betrayal if people talk your things? Are your things secret?
Maybe if I share my emotional statement, and then, but then, you know, most people are white or blue today, and then tomorrow they are something else, that type of people.
But is this not just an idea that you have?
Maybe it's just an idea, but I'm just scared, and I'm also finding it difficult to make friends.
because you're awkward. It's not really because you don't trust people. I think you want to trust people and you want to have friends. I think that you are just socially awkward. So socially awkward is people that that don't really mix into the party just like that.
Yeah.
So when you go and stand somewhere, you would just stand, you know? It's not like somebody comes inside and then them, they already go to the what, and then they go and sit down somewhere and start talking to people. You're not like that. Yeah. So you are what we classify as socially awkward, but awkward is good because you live in a time where we embrace individuality and we embrace being awkward, because we have figured that normalcy has caused so much peer pressure amongst our youth for a very long time that we now embrace your identity the way it is. Mm-hmm. So where are you looking for friends? Where do you think friends come from? Let's start there, huh? Where do you think friends come from?
Yeah, friends can come from anywhere. Like, I can just meet anyone. Maybe at the playground or, yeah, at church. At school, yeah, I can meet a friend there. Where do we find friends?
I strongly believe that with you, you are not an ordinary statistic. So you will not be able to find friends at church. You will not be able to find friends in any of these places that you're talking about. No. I would say that your friend needs to come from the library.
But also in the library, there are serious people there.
Yeah. But you are also a serious person. So those people in the library, they are your cup of tea. They are the types of friends that you need. That would appreciate you and you would appreciate them.
Okay.
Friendship is not about being silly, eh? Friendship is not about being fun all the time. We make different friends for different experiences, and sometimes we just make one friend, and that's the friend that carries us through life. Yeah. Somebody that understands your quirky behavior and your witty personality, but also understands that you're socially anxious and you're socially awkward. So I would say, right, look within your class to know the faces of the people in your class, right? And then go to the library. When you go to the library and you recognize somebody, if they are not sitting in a clique and they are sitting by themselves, then you can approach them and ask to sit with them. And then you introduce yourself. And then you say that, no, I've seen you in one of my classes. My name is Elizabeth. Yes. Because you enjoy silence anyways and you are used to it, you can just sit there for even 3 hours. Yeah, it doesn't bother you.
Yeah.
You can just sit there and it doesn't bother you. And then you guys, you can sit there and then you can study together just in that moment. if you don't understand something, you can ask and you also approach them nicely. Like, I don't mean to bother you. I know that you're very busy, but do you understand this thing? You know? No. Then you guys start talking. Yeah. Then you guys start having conversations. Then you start looking forward to going to the library. You start looking forward to being around that friend of yours that you make. It doesn't have to go as far as, oh, come over to my house. Oh, let's do this. It doesn't have to go as far as that, because it's not every friendship dynamics that looks the same. Yeah. Do you consider you and I to be friends?
Yes.
Why?
Because we're learning a lot from you.
And am I learning a lot from you? I thought friendships, you know, I thought you give and you take in friendships.
Yeah, it's true, you give and then you take from friendships. But then you say no, there are different dynamics in friendships.
You see? Smart girl.
Yeah.
So, your best bet right now to make a friend is to make a friend in the library. And even when they leave, you can always say that, when are you coming back to the library? I really enjoyed spending time here at the library with you, because you seem like a very serious person. And maybe I can learn a few things from you. Yeah. That means that every week, twice a week, right, you're going to meet up with this person that is also most probably socially awkward, like you, and you guys are going to spend time in the library studying, which is a fun activity that you like to do and that this person also likes to do, that you guys have in common. Yeah. Then you take it from there. Then you just see it's been 10 years.
Yeah, I will try that out.
You need to get to know what type of person you are. I think you are a two-word person. You don't talk a lot. You don't talk a lot. You're a two-word kind of person. It's not that you don't have a lot to say. You do have a lot to say. But you are just, you are paced. You pace yourself. You grew up, it's like you grew up with an old woman. It's like you grew up with an old woman. Children that grow up with old people, they are usually very patient. So it's not like, you can find one that grew up with an old person that talks a lot, but everything in their step is very patient. And also even in their temper, it's very patient, because seniors are known to be very slow because of their age. Like, mobility wise, they are slow, and they are also slow to anger. So they are patient, and they give this attribute to the children that they stay with. That's why you find some of us can listen to somebody's story for 10 hours and not get tired.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So find your friend in the library. Find your friend in the library. Go and look for one of those nice corners. Then you find that person sitting by themselves. And don't judge them. So whatever they are wearing. It's none of you Christian chicks. If I'm wearing a crop top, you think I'm for the streets. Find me wearing a mini skirt, you think I'm for the streets. And don't lecture anyone. You know, the Bible says, ha, ha. Okay. I'm not saying that you should shy away from God. I'm just saying, don't lecture anyone. I know you guys always have a need to lecture because you guys always want to be evangelizing. Every day is evangelism. But it's not really that. You're looking for a friend. You're looking for somebody to laugh with. You guys can be laughing about anything. I'm sure you're gonna be okay.
Once you're close friends again, now evangelize.
Do you believe in unconditional love? Tell me what your idea of unconditional love is, please.
Unconditional love. To see your love someone beyond. Like when you love someone, it's like, oh. Love someone beyond the things, maybe beyond the bad things that they're doing.
Does it always have to be associated to bad? Because it's unconditional, right? It doesn't have any conditions. Any conditions could be bad, could be good. What is the one thing that human beings all need, which is, I believe that every single human being walking this earth wants to be accepted. Wants to be accepted in their true form, in their true essence. So, acceptance, right, of a person's true form and being is what we can assume to be unconditional love. When you accept the person exactly the way they are. Now, if we as human beings have a tendency of wanting to constantly change the people around us, can we truly say we are capable of unconditional love? Is it unconditional love if we are constantly wanting to change people? Is it not conditional then? I will love you if you are the way I want you to be.
I'm not saying that you should change your, not that you should change your mind, the way you are, not the way you are thinking, but maybe you have an idea, because I know you will be agreeing at some point. I just think that it's not, it's like this.
Because you want to evangelize to your future friend. You don't even have a friend yet. And you're already thinking of changing them. And the person is not even here yet. You didn't even get them yet. And you're already thinking of changing them. So you are already assuming that they are not going to be perfect. Just the way they are. No, you can evangelize. You can evangelize. I'm just a strong believer in know why you are doing the things that you're doing. Yeah. Know why you're doing the things that you're doing. If you're going to practice unconditional kindness or unconditional love, then it must be unconditional love. Otherwise, we have to look at the true concept of love and ask ourselves if we are capable of it or not.
The word of God, and then when we are on the top of our feet.
Chomi, you really have to change, eh? You need to repent, give your life to Christ. Do you know that if you confess with your tongue and speak with your mouth, eh, you will be saved? Chomi, Chomi, do you know what Jesus said? Chomi, eh? Ha!
No, it's going to be a step-by-step thing. It's going to be a step-by-step thing. It depends on the person whether he wants it or not.
Mm-hmm. And then if they don't want it, then you start pulling away because they are not what you want.
No, not really.
Because if you are not in Jesus, if you're not into Jesus like me, then I don't want that. The Christian kids. The Christian kids, they say things like, don't judge others. Hey, but they are very judgmental.
It's not true. That one is not true.
You are already anticipating evangelizing. Your friend is not even here yet. And then I'm going to evangelize. Say, ah. What if they know the Bible more than you?
That's even a bonus for me. We are not debating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you know you're not debating? Is it because you're speaking in a calm voice and tone? Does that make it not debating? Because if you're telling me to change my ways, because Jesus doesn't like that, in whatever way that you say it, if you're a person like me, in whatever way that you say it, because I look past it. I look past your tone. I look past your saying. I look past how you put words together. For me, it's the choice of words for me that matter. I just pinned, for me, I always say that, one must always be careful with what you say to me. It's not really how you say it, because how you say it, I can always translate it. I can always decipher it, because if you are angry right now and you say something that is very true, but in a very harsh tone, I will look past the harsh tone and look at what you are actually saying to me. And then I can accept it because this is what you're actually saying. Now other people look at tone, like the way you said it, like, huh? Was it true or not? You know? I hope you're going to be happy.
I hope I find myself a friend.
Yeah, because it's kind of lonely.
It's true.
It's kind of lonely, and all your peers are in bars. All your peers are in bars, and all your peers are having kids. All your peers are having coitus. I understand your need for a friend.
Understanding.
I understand. I understand why you need a friend. It's not fun. But also, maybe you should try volunteering in the church. Try volunteering in the church, and then at least have conversations with those people. Not really to become friends, but just acquaintances. Even if it's just going to sweep the Sunday school sometimes, you know, or just helping out in the church, because I think that the church is your comfort zone. It's the one place that you feel safe and comfortable. So maybe you should try volunteering in the church. And I just don't want you to, I don't want you to spend more than one day in a week at the church. Apart from Sundays. I don't want you to do that. I don't want you to become consumed by the church. I want you to have one activity that you do at church. Just one. That doesn't have many responsibilities. That doesn't have what what. You can even go clean the windows. Yeah. Just one activity where now and then you see other peers. Or sing in the choir or something. But don't get too consumed by the church, because the church is comfortable. The church is safe. So in our comfortability and our safety, with the world being so harsh outside, we tend to drown within the church, and then the church consumes us. It's not the church's intention. It is our own need to want to be safe that pushes us now to overdo things within the church. Yeah. It's not because the church is bad. It's because we want to. The world is so dangerous outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the world is so dangerous outside. So now when we find the safe haven within the church, we often tend to cling to it. And when we cling to it, it consumes us, because there are so many activities. But the activities that are within the church are not meant for one single person to be doing every single activity at church. And that is why you find some of your peers are church nuts. Because Monday they're at Bible study, Tuesday they're at choir, Wednesday they're at all-night prayers, Thursday they're at fasting congregation, what. Eh? And then you just see it Sunday, but when do you have time to study? Or even just be at home? So you pick one thing within the church that you would really like to do. Even if it's Bible studies on Wednesdays, you know, you look at the church calendar. Maybe you can do Bible studies on Wednesdays when the church offers it, right? And then you participate in that activity. And that is going to be your one activity where you have conversations. And you have your views and your opinions. Because I think that you are actually a very bold girl, huh? You're like a bold girl with opinions and facts, and you are smart. And if anybody gives you the time in day, and anybody gives you that platform, you really can be vibrant and all of that. It's just a matter of people not always looking at the one that is shiny. You like to hide in the shadows.
Thank you for the nice words.
Nah. You're welcome. You deserve them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's time for me to say goodbye.
Goodbye, my dear. What is your name, by the way? You know I don't know your name for 3 years. I just know you swag up around this with parents and swag up. I know your whole life. I just don't know your name. Yes, that's why I asked you. Are you in swag up or are you in around this? And how is that going? So now are you renting or are you living at a family home or where are you staying? Because you had a living issue, Moss. With your biological mother?
With my biological mother.
How is she?
How is she?
Yeah, like how is she? Like in terms of how is she with you?
She's fine.
Is she fine?
She's fine.
Your home situation is fine?
It's fine.
You sure?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Where was she all this time? Yeah.
Yeah, she was just here in Morocco.
Mm-hmm. Then why did you want to go live with your dad?
Because the campus is there, like, the place where I'm studying.
So you wanted to be walking to school? You're such a good child. You don't want your parents to waste taxi money. Yeah.
Yeah, it's only my mom that is helping me, so I'm trying to look out for them. But for now, we are sort of all fine.
Does your mom have other children?
It's only me.
Only you? How? Nobody fears pregnancy like a mother of one. Eh? She decided, no, never. This one is enough. Okay, then it explains a lot about your, about yourself. You're an only child.
Sorry?
You're an only child. From your mom, you're an only child. Okay. So you learned how to play alone.
To be alone.
Yeah, you learn. Yeah, so.
This holiday, my father's child came to come visit us. And then she went, and then, it became lonelier. Like, we were in the same room, we were talking, and then we were doing things together, and then she went.
Oh. How many children do you plan to have in your life? 10. Ten kids. I want offense. You want to help orphans, no? Nah. That's your calling in life. That's what you want to do. What are you going to do for the orphans?
Maybe I will adopt two or...
And then your family is going to tell your children nonsense. Because as our African families, you're not so busy, you're not even my cousin's biological child. What are you doing here? This is our family. It's my blood. Not unless you lie. You don't have to lie. You just have to go away for 9 months and come back with a baby.
But my idea is just to give them love and a better future for them to have everything that their parents would have given them.
I have a friend of mine. He was adopted, right? I almost said his name. But this was now bad manners to say. His name is JP. Anyhow, so this friend of mine, this guy, he was adopted by his parents. His parents were a bit senior and they didn't have any children. And they adopted this child and they gave this child everything. They had money. Like, it wasn't like state house kind of money, but they just had a comfortable life. And they loved this child so much. And then, right? In his late 20s or in his early mid 20s, this child starts doing drugs. And this child became these two people's nightmare to the extent where they even got a divorce. Imagine getting a divorce in your 50s, 60s. I'm just saying. And then you find there are other people that have been adopted and you'll never even know that they're adopted because they treat their parents with respect and everything. So you don't plan on having children of your own? You just want to adopt?
Yeah, I will get the ones that are mine. But basically, I just want maybe one or two of them. Just two.
Are you going to teach them about their birth parents?
Mm.
It's so that when they're 18, they go back to their mother's family. Let me not discourage you. Let me not discourage you. What I can say is, think about it first. Think about all the possible options. You could open an orphanage, right? How about you open an orphanage with a beautiful system of the children know you as mother, right? And you spend your time there. You might even live there. And you make sure that the children go to a good home, a good and loving home. And you make sure to check up on your children all the time to make sure that they're actually living a good life.
Yeah, that even sounds good.
Yeah. So they all know that you are their mother. All of them, all 20 of them, all 50 of them, they all know that you, when you are their mother. Right? Because you are the mother of the orphanage. But I think that in that way you make a bigger impact. I'm not really keen on adoption.
And at the same time, I can have my family.
If you want to have a family. Because at the end of the day, right? I don't think that you want that. I think you just want to live your life in Christ and help as many people as you can and just find joy in that. Maybe along the years you'll change your mind. Maybe along the years you, but I don't see those relationship things.
Maybe along the years,
you will get to that point. Because, I mean, who you are right now is not who you are going to be in the next 3 years. So, it's okay. Because you're not there yet. Maybe you get to a point where you are a whole teacher and you're like, you know what? I can't, no. I just want a quiet life where I'm drinking wine. Yeah. I want kids. Ah, no. Yeah. Maybe you might be a surrogate mother where you just carry children for other people. You don't know. But what you want to do is help, right? So I'm sure that's in your cards. Maybe you're going to find a guy that's going to sweep you off your feet, get you pregnant, and you never finish school. Who knows?
Yeah.
Look at this one here. No, that's not what we want. How? We want you to finish school. How? Yeah. Finish school and make it out there in the world. But your mother will be very happy to be somebody's grandmother. She'll be very happy. All right, my beloved. Have a good night.
Good night.
Already? Oh! Now you want to cry. Ciao! It was so nice talking about myself. In my future.
Already a good night.
Already? How? Why? The party just got started. Is there any question that you have whatsoever that you would like to pose my way?
No.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all. I'm just feeling happy.
Mm-hmm.
That we spoke, because it's been a while, and I also wanted to listen to the radio, but there is no
data. Download the app, ne?
There is no data.
Why?
There is nothing.
Why is there no data? You don't have funny social things where you are on TikTok and all of that. You almost not like that. So why don't you have data? How did your data finish just like that? Eh? What are you doing just watching church sermons? Hallelujah. Worship songs for 2 hours. Download the thing. Download, like on the YouTube. Download it and put it in your library so that even if you don't have data, you go and listen to it. This thing of just streaming it. How?
So it's also like that
there. Yes, you go into the YouTube and then you go and download it. Like the option to download is always there. You download it and then it falls into your library, right? And then even when you don't have data, then you can go and listen to your things. And watch your things. That's why Happy Hour was a thing. Mm-hmm. Now our phones are just full. We don't know. Can this, because of our YouTube history. We are saving our things, yes.
Well, I will play that one.
Yeah. Now you're just streaming your whole entire data on the worship song. Here I am to worship. Here I am. Yeah? Alpha and Omega.
So you don't listen to those songs?
I do. How do you think I know that? God of the hills and valleys. I know all of them.
Okay.
Like I'm one of those deep hardcore Christians. I just don't like it when the mainstream Christians come at me. People don't assume that I'm like a Christian. I'm very rooted. It's only that I'm also African. And people don't understand it. People don't understand that I respect culture and I respect Christianity at the same time. I respect where I come from, my origins, and then I also respect God.
Okay.
Mm. So you don't need to evangelize to me because there are so many things that, I mean, I can give you backflips. There's no Bible page that you're going to give me that I don't know. I can give you backflips upon backflips. Chua! It's karate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm also cool. So it's wow. Huh?
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm all these things and then I'm cool also. It's like, wow. Yeah. I want a friend like Matriarch. Yeah. Somebody that can make you laugh in the middle of the night. Now your mother's like, who is she talking to? I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, I was calling into the radio. You are lying. You ask my friend Dan from the radio. Alright, okay. Bye my dear.
Okay, bye.
Ciao, ciao. God bless you.
Yeah, the same.
Okay. Because maybe you keep telling people, other people, God bless you, but nobody tells you. God bless you from me to you. Ah. Evangelist. We must call you Eva. Evangelist. The evangelizer. All right, my dear.
Okay, love you.
And I love you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, hello. Welcome to our Wednesday edition where we are going to talk about a lot of stuff, but eventually we're going to get there. Ladies and gentlemen, the number in studio is 083-288-401. And on Wednesdays, we just have counseling sessions. We just have sessions where we are just talking our own things. So please do call through and have a lovely and beautiful conversation. If you want to, argue, you can also come and argue because I got that feisty in me. But all in all, what I was talking about today is I was talking about how many of us are bullying our brains. We are bullying ourselves. You know, we are beating ourselves up about things that we can't change, and we are beating ourselves up about being in a certain state and being in a certain way, and we just can't change it. You know, I've always been one of those kids where I think it's intuition. Well, not kids even, just people. I think it's intuition. I'm very intuitive. I'm those people that you can talk to, and I can read you. I can read you. I can read your life. I can read your struggles. I can relate. And some people say that's an empath. Some people say that's psychic. Some people say Oshiluri. Some people say it's lucky guesses, and some people cannot pinpoint what it is. And there was always a question, right? Where I spent a lot of time in my room growing up in general. And when I say my room, please don't think that it was like a mansion where I'm like on a queen size bed and it has extra foam and extra what. It was just my little space where it was just a bed in a room that we share with others. And my mom is one of those active parents. So she would notice instantly when you're not around. She would also notice if you don't feel good. She was very attentive, especially to me. She was very attentive because for her, I'm an ideal kid, you know? I'm ideal. Like, I'm an okay kid. You know, I'm not perfect, but I'm an okay kid compared to others. I'm an okay kid. And you know, when I had my depressive episodes and my anxious episodes, she would always ask questions like, what would make you happy? What would make you feel better? And I used to have answers. I would say, yeah, no, just music, you know, or I would like to record something, or I would like to write, or I used to have answers for what would make you feel better. But I've noticed along the years that I lost that answer. I lost the answer of what would make me feel better, and gained the answer of why. Why do we constantly have the need to feel better? Why do we always want to bypass the emotion, bypass what's happening, and move on to the happy parts? Is it because we are incapable of sitting within our situation, or sitting within our problems? Or is it because maybe we are struggling with our reality as we know it? I don't know. Right? But it was something. It was a question of why. Why do we need to make ourselves feel better? And what happens to what we're feeling? And this had an impact on my life, so to say, because now I started sitting within my moments. And I started being, you know, just being. You know how you feel bad? And you're like, you know what? Let me just go for a run and I'll feel much better. And let me go and do this and I'll feel much better. I'm the complete opposite. If I feel bad, if I am having a moment, right? Then I just have it. I just sit within it. There are days, right, where I have to drag myself out of bed in the morning. And it's not to say that I don't love what I'm doing outside there. It's not to say that I don't love being the person that I am. It's just to say that I'm having a rough day. I'm having a rough day. I'm having a rough morning. I'm having a rough 30s. I think that for me, I think that when we look at where we are, apart from having gratitude for the material things or the mental stability or whatever milestone that we have reached, right? I think that we romanticize fragments of our pasts to make ourselves feel better. So when we romanticize something, we make it romantic. So it's like you saying that, you know, money can't buy happiness. You're romanticizing poverty, right? You're making poverty seem like it's this, it's the ultimate, you know, it's the ultimate sacrifice that we have to make if we love people. You know, we just have to go through life with them and poverty will go away if we just work hard together and. But we don't talk about, we don't talk about the empty bellies. We don't talk about hair loss. We don't talk about looking absolutely happy while going through tragedy. Ladies and gentlemen.
Get all your essential products for just 99 Namibian dollars at USAID. 1 kilogram each of Rice King rice, Top Score or Bokomo Super Maize Meal, Sugar King, white or brown sugar, 500 grams Pasta Polana or Pasta King, and 750 milliliters Right Brand Sunflower Seed Oil. All five products for only 99 Namibian dollars. You save. I save. Yes, we all save at You Save.
Alrighty. So, ladies and gentlemen, today we are going to be diving into a series of unknown thoughts, a series of unknown conversations. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to dive into the minds of those we leave behind and the survivors and, we're doing that. From me to you, I give you guys the disclaimer that Eagle FM does not take ownership of any of the clips that we play. They are strictly for illustration purposes. They are a conversation that we are hearing from all over the world. Ladies and gentlemen, brace yourselves for conversations. Brace yourselves for monologues from people that have lost, from people that have mourned and grieved. Because, whoa.
In 2016, on a very normal Thursday, July morning, my husband Dave and I were going through the motions, getting ourselves ready for work, and our two young daughters, Eve and Zoe, ready for daycare. It was a beautiful day out, so I very naturally took the girls with me in the car so Dave could ride his motorcycle to work. I was in a rush, as usual, so I just blew him an air kiss from the driveway, like, and off I went. At around 2 p.m., the police showed up in my office to ask if I knew a David Budek. I remember the feeling of my stomach dropping. I said, he rode his motorcycle to work. Was there an accident? Is he dead? He wasn't dead, but there was an accident. They were going to drive me to the hospital to see him. I arrived at the hospital through the police and ambulance entrance with no one else around, and was eventually taken into the trauma ICU to see Dave for less than a minute, just to make sure that it was my Dave they were working on. And then I waited and waited. After more waiting and signing paperwork for an eventual surgery, I left the hospital, but barely slept that night. Throughout the time in hospital, it wasn't that I was holding on so tightly to hope. I actually thought Dave would recover. I called our insurance company to find out what coverage we had for his eventual rehabilitation needs. In my small, brown, spiral-bound notebook, I tracked everything going on in that room. I tracked the numbers and beeps from the machines. I counted the staples in his head, and there were 50 from ear to ear. And I wrote down every word the doctors were saying so that when Dave recovered, I could tell him about it. Being the scientist he was, I knew he would want the details. 40 days after Dave's accident, on the night before Eve's very first day of kindergarten, at 8:08 p.m., Dave died. I became a widow at the age of 33 with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. What was I going to do? Well, what do most of us seem to do these days when we just don't know the answer to something? We Google it? Do you know if you Google how to support a widow, the first thing that pops up is a list with 10 suggestions. There's also a picture of two elderly women holding each other. And the number one recommendation, bring food and coordinate food drop-offs with others so that grievers have one less thing to think about. When Dave was in the hospital and after he died, people brought food. And Google was right. It was helpful. And the rest of the suggestions on that list are definitely helpful too. But what I want to talk about today is what happens after the so-called grieving period is over, when it seems that people want those grieving to get back to normal and not be so sad anymore. In different religions and regions across the world, grieving and mourning look different, but generally, we don't know what to say to each other. How many of you have Googled what to write in a sympathy card? We struggle with how to interact with each other when people die every day. Not just weeks after loss, but what happens months or years later when life keeps going? I'll tell you what happens. We stop talking about our people who died. Life goes on. And we get busy. I get it. But what would it look like if we were more intentional and made it the norm to talk about our people who have died, to say their names and tell their stories? Let me tell you how you can support a grieving widow years later. Quite simply, talk about their person who died. After Dave died, I got a lot of well-intentioned, let me know if I can do anything offers, but I knew I wasn't reaching out. I had to pretend that we could live a normal life. I stuck to the nightly routine Dave followed because asking for help for what I eventually realized I did need might signal that I wasn't okay and that I couldn't do it on my own. So that meant talking about Dave less and just focusing on everything else that needed to be done. And then it got harder to talk about Dave because I thought that if I did, people might think that I was stuck in grief. I remember this one time someone asking me how I was doing, you know, with the head tilt and eye squint and that unconscious look of pity. How are you doing? You know what I said? We're doing okay. Yep. I'm figuring it out. We're doing okay. I walked away, got into my car, and suddenly the tears were just gushing down. And I was doing the ugly cry that you can only really do in the car or in the shower. Basically anywhere you're alone, so nobody will see you lose it. Yeah, it turns out I was not okay, but grief is complicated. And fast forward to today, I can honestly say that most days I'm okay. I'm also totally comfortable saying now that some days I'm still not. Being okay and being resilient are unconscious pressures placed on people in grief. Doing well in the face of adversity is so subjective. If resilience looks at your capacity to recover quickly from a difficult situation and bounce back to normal, there is simply no resilience possible from this type of loss. I can't bounce back to the life I had because Dave isn't here anymore. I will never get back a future that is forever gone. Resiliency for widows isn't about bouncing back. It's about creating a meaningful life with the way things are now. What I have found is making meaning of my life now has to include talking about Dave. His life and his death influenced and shaped me into who I am today. And while not all widows want to talk about their dead husbands, I can tell you that when I feel free to do so, I'm comforted by my memories that continue to have this place to live. I found the most welcoming environments to talk about Dave and his death and life since his death have been with my fellow young widows, whether that's in person or online. These online organizations, groups, therapists, blogs are all there to support those in grief, and I think they are most helpful when they complement our existing relationships with our family and friends. For example, a widow in Florida can offer a lot of comfort and support simply by having a shared life-altering experience. But she doesn't know Dave. She can't laugh at his quirks and remind me that he would never pay full price for anything. He loved clipping coupons. We are on the verge of becoming a community where we can openly talk about people after they have died. Except people don't know what to say to someone who is grieving. Or quite frankly, they're worried they're going to say the wrong thing. So it can seem easier not to mention the person at all. But just how you want to share stories of your loved ones, I want you all to know about Dave's annoying obsession with sunflower seeds. He would eat them one by one at his computer desk every night, and lucky me would shift to the bed if he was finished checking his emails before his tiny Tupperware of seeds was empty. Acknowledging relationships can be complicated, but in my opinion, part of life includes talking about our people who have died. But isn't it interesting that we don't talk about death? We purposefully avoid talking about death because it produces this terror-inducing fear that one day we will die too. We have so much anxiety knowing we will die, we do anything we can to avoid talking about it. So let me clarify. We don't need to talk about death. We just need to talk about our people who died. Communities exist that talk about people who have passed away, but you may be thinking, when is it appropriate? The next time you see something that makes you think about someone who has died, or you have a memory or a thought that you want to share, share it. Talking about somebody's dead husband doesn't make them more upset or remind us that they died. Trust me, we remember, we know. And if you say something that makes someone emotional, it's okay. As I tell my kids when they get upset seeing me upset, it's okay to cry. I will tell Zoe, my youngest, Daddy died and it's sad. And so I'm going to be sad for a moment. Bringing up memories about someone who has died means they mattered. They still matter. They aren't forgotten. Eve and Zoe have very limited memories of their dad. Talking about Dave will be the only way they get to know who he was. Seeing the COVID-19 statistics unfold and the death rate continue to rise has made me think about two things. One, Dave would have been all over the science behind this pandemic, and we would have looked quite prepared thanks to the seemingly lifetime supply of cleaning and paper products, thanks to his extreme couponing. And two, there are new COVID widows and widowers out there, and their wounds are still raw. So while they may not be ready to talk about their loved ones just yet, in 3 or 4 years from now, they may be. It's been over 4 years since my Dave died, and the sadness, while still always there, feels a little less unbearable, and it gets easier to listen to the ways others choose to talk about Dave. My sister recently told me that the family used to place bets on which shirt Dave would be wearing when we came to visit, because majority of the time it was his favorite white shirt with yellow sleeves, this waffle shirt from Old Navy. And that shirt is now Eve's daddy shirt and has been in her bed with her every night since the day of his funeral. I've also taken that shirt with me to school concerts and plays because she tells me she feels like he's watching her too. And because Eve is still so young, I went to eBay and I bought a backup daddy shirt just to have for when his shirt wears out completely. Talk about people when there are big decisions to make. For instance, hearing someone who knew Dave say they think he would have understood my decision to move brought so much comfort. Holidays and birthdays are more obvious hard times, and you can still mention the person. But the hard times are also the really good times. Eve earned her yellow belt in karate the same day she did well on a difficult math test last year, and that was hard because Dave should be here for this. He should be here to watch his children grow up. But he's not here. He's missing and is going to continue missing all the milestones. He isn't in any back to school pictures. He won't teach his girls to drive. He won't see them graduate. And he won't be with them on their wedding days. So when you think about when would be a tough time for a widow, check in when things are seemingly really good. That might just be the perfect time for a reminder that years later, Dave still matters. Time passes and grief changes. When you aren't sure what to say to a widow or anybody who's experienced loss, it's okay to ask, can I talk about Dave? Do you talk about him in front of your kids? Just asking questions tells me he matters. If a widow says they like talking about their late partner, go for it. But if they don't, doesn't matter why, just accept it, move on. Regardless of how uncomfortable you may feel, you've asked a question that acknowledges a person existed. My story, while sad, is not consumed in and doesn't end in sadness. I am so lucky to have known a love so deep that it cannot die with the person. And I'm beyond grateful to have repartnered with someone who told me he watched a movie he thinks Dave would have liked. We have talked about Dave to the point where someone who never had the chance to know him knows him. Those who work with people preparing for death will tell us that when somebody is dying, they just want to know that their lives have been meaningful. Did they make a difference in this world? What will they be remembered for? If we stop talking about people after they die, then really, what are they being remembered for? Dave was the smartest man I've ever known. I will continue to tell his story and love sharing. His favorite mantra was, never pay someone to do a job that you could learn how to do yourself. He read how-to books for fun and studied the owner's manuals of items we hadn't even bought yet, like our vacuum cleaner, just to make sure it was the perfect one for us. There's a saying that a person actually dies twice. The first time is when they take their last breath, and the second time is when somebody says their name for the last time. I want you to keep in mind that talking about our people who have died helps keep their memory alive. It keeps them alive. How are you going to support someone in their grief years after loss?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, hello. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is a Wednesday. And, you know, today is one of those days. Today is one of those days where I'm looking for, I'm looking to stir up a little something within your hearts, right? And I've been thinking. So it's 2021 and, you know, we've gone through the motions of COVID and we are still going through the motions of COVID. And it is cemetery visit after cemetery visit every third day, every fourth day. And I now do a body count on people that have been meaningful to me in my little life and people that mattered to me and people that I loved. And I come up to a whooping number. And this number baffled me so much. And I am one of those people that I deem myself to be very sensitive. But along the years, along these 4 years, right? I think I've reached a point where I've desensitized myself a little bit because I used to overfeel and I used to over and over, right? And I was thinking about it today. I was thinking about functioning depression. I was thinking about the people that go through their lives, right? Being functional and being there and being present and being amazing and being fine. And then the next minute you just hear that the person is no longer here and the person has passed away. And the question is always how, you know, like how did the person die? And it has been one of those conversations that I've even made it a point, you know, to look for that specific comment, especially on the social media, I've made it like, it's like a little game. I know it's like a weird game. It's a sick game. It's desensitive, but it is like a game I have. Every time somebody announces someone's death, I go and look for the comment of how. Nobody asks when. Nobody asks anything else. Nobody asks how are you doing and how are you holding up and is there anything I can do for you? Nobody says that. Everybody asks how. And I wanted to know why people ask how. Why do we feel the need to know what happened to the person? And I went deeper, you know, read a couple of philosophies and read a couple of psychiatrists and psychologists' work. And the only thing that I can truly come up with is the fear of death. And many of us have the fear of death to such an extent that we need to know why other people or how other people died so that we can find a way within our hearts or within our minds to avoid that, to avoid whatever they did wrong to make them die. We avoid it. And I think that this is a different step of grief, you know, it's a different paragraph when it comes to grief. I believe that grief is everlasting. It just becomes bitter. It just becomes more bearable. It just becomes an elephant that we live with. It becomes shrunk. We shrink it actually. Shrunken. It becomes shrunken. Or we shrink it and it becomes a monument or a vase or a vase on our tables. And it's there, but it's not there. Now, for people that have experienced grief, I would say that grief it's crazy. It's crazy because 1 minute you're fine and the next you're breaking down. It's crazy because today we are on top of the world and tomorrow as well. And then like a sugar crash, it just comes tumbling down. I remember there was a day where I was working through Vernhill and I had this overwhelming sense of grief, you know, like sadness. And I had to sit down and I had to just cry, you know. And somebody asked like, oh, are you okay? And I was like, no, I'm just mourning. It's like, oh, okay. You know, and this person sat and we sat and then until I felt better. And the question was, does it ever get better? And if you are out there tonight and you're thinking like, yo, but am I ever going to survive this? Am I ever going to be okay? You know, your mom died or your dad died or your friend died or your cousin died or the stranger next door. You didn't really know them like that, but it touched your heart. I believe that many of us truly and only understand death when death is in our household. Because if it is at somebody else's house, right, we leave it there. We leave it there, we wash our hands, and we go. And when we go and start our days, and we might even forget for a couple of seconds, you know. We might even forget that Susan is dead or Susan passed away. And we ask questions like how, so that we can have a sense of carefulness within our lives. So if we hear it's a car accident, then we associate it to alcohol, to speeding, or to witchcraft, or to being in a bad state. We must associate it to something, right? So this is what we associate it to. But the truth is that we'll never know because we were not in that moment. And whatever makes us feel better, right? I remember when my friend took his life, right? It came as a shocker. It came as a shocker because I've always deemed him to be a very dramatic person. And this is his birth month, right? This is his birth month. This is his time. This is his time in heaven. This month, July. And I thought about him. I thought about him today and I was like, I know how, you know? And I've always deemed him to be dramatic. And in his drama, he went out dramatically as well. And I don't think we talk about it enough. And I don't think that, like, what is her name? Like, Terry over here was saying that we have a tendency of trying to forget the dead. We have a tendency of trying to sweep their names under the rug and make them seem like they never existed. They were never here. They were never a part of our existence, our lives, because we assume it to be too painful for other people to bear. So we keep quiet. But one thing that I know is that for somebody that has lost, I feel that for you as a friend or as an outsider to the family, for you to completely just never talk about this person it's weird. I ask questions like, don't you miss them? Do you think about them? The only people that want to talk about this person is their immediate family. But how many of us have called our friends that have lost people? And we ask, how are you doing? You know, how are you doing since the passing of somebody? You know, you know this person for a lifetime. You know them for such a long time, right? You know this person for a lifetime and they're boxed away in a little box, and this box is hidden somewhere far. And it's like a curse when you say their names. It's like, oh, don't say their names. You know, it's like Gargamel is coming, Smurfs. Don't say their name. It becomes like almost like a taboo, especially amongst our Black culture. I feel that many of us don't embrace the conversation around death. And when death happens, our children are unaware of it. And they suffer because they have to learn on the go, learning that, hey, it's so people do pass away and people do die. And this is what happens. And it comes like a shocker. And many of us are sitting in depressed situations. And it's because of the impact of this person's passing that nobody really wanted to address. I have a friend of mine that had experienced death. And she experienced death in a large quantity. It was a lot of loss of people that she loved all at one time. And I can tell you now that she has never been the same ever since. And she came back into the same environment. And this environment was harsh. It was harsh because there was nothing happy. There was nothing happy to talk about. Nobody spoke about anybody. And at the time where I would like to bring up the conversation, it had now officially become an uncomfortable conversation. So it was always met with, It was never a conversation that was worthy of having. And also many of us, we weep when we talk about the dead, but we don't acknowledge that they were here, that they had lives, they did great things, they did funny things. Some people were comedians, some people were loving, some people were all these elements. And it seems as though the day we put them in the box, into the sand, is the day we forget about them completely. So ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about grief.
From sunrise to supper time, Namib Mills is there, feeding the nation with care, quality, and heart.
We believe food is more than nourishment. It's dignity. It's hope. It's the start of a better tomorrow.
Through sustainable production processes, job creation, and affordable, nutritious food, Namib Mills is driving economic growth one plate at a time. Because when we say feeding the nation,
we mean uplifting lives,
empowering communities, and building a future where no one is left behind.
Namib Mills, proudly Namibian,
passionately feeding the nation. Namib Mills,
feeding the nation.
There's a black and white picture of my mom at the age of 16 hanging on the wall of my living room. She's resting her chin in the palm of her hand. And she's actually wearing this ring, a blue star sapphire that my father gave her. My three daughters see that picture every day. My three-year-old has actually started pointing to it and saying, "That's not my mommy. That's my grandma." "Yes, that's mommy's mommy," we all say. Months ago, my 7-year-old sat next to me and said, a little out of nowhere, "Your mommy and dad are dead. You have no parents." "That's true," I responded. I looked at her green-gray eyes, her lashes, her eyebrows, and she looked right back at me. Then she put her head on my chest, and I rested my chin on the top of her head. I savor these moments when my girls talk out loud about my mom and my dad, and they wrestle a bit with their absence. You know, they have to work things out in their head about what my parents might have been to them and how we as a family can weave them into our lives and how to navigate death's disruptiveness. I mean, this is really important stuff. I know some people say it's too much for kids, it's too heavy, it's too dark, it's too complicated, but I adamantly disagree. My experience has taught me that grief needs to be heard. And this kind of openness can be life-saving. March 1st, 1981. I had just turned 5 about 4 days before. I was sleeping in my grandmother's bed, which I often did on the weekends. I woke up in the middle of the night and I saw a thin line of light at the base of the bathroom door. And I looked over and my grandmother wasn't in bed with me. Just seconds later, she emerged from the bathroom fully dressed. She knelt down next to the bed, got really close to my face, and she said, "I have to go. Your mommy's sick." I didn't sleep the rest of the night. My great aunt read me lots of books. The pokey little puppy is the one that I remember the most. For minutes at a time that night, I pictured my mom, you know, shivering in a sick bed, covered with a warm, thick blanket, a thermometer hanging off her lips like a cigarette. The next morning, early, the front door of my grandmother's apartment opened and the white light of the sun burst through it. The dark silhouettes of my father and grandmother floated through the doorway like apparitions. My mom was not with them. My dad sat on the sofa in front of me. My grandmother, his mother, seated next to him. And he said, "Your mommy's in heaven now. She's with the angels." Now, in that moment, I understood the permanence of what I just heard. I mean, even at the age of 5, when a lot of children don't register the finality of death, I understood at my core, in my center, that I would never, ever see my mother again. My research on grief, and believe me, I've done a lot of research on grief since 1981, has taught me that children often manifest their grief very physically. They literally embody their feelings. I walked in circles around the center of my grandmother's living room over and over and over, stomping my feet. Raising her hand to me and reaching out, my grandmother said, "You can call me mommy now." In a split second, I shot back, "No. No, you're not my mommy." My dad sat with his eyes turned down. I mean, that moment for me is really remarkable as I think about it, because it marks the point in time where my family and I chose two very different paths. I mean, I was barely 5, right? I had just learned minutes before that my mother was dead. Struggling with their own shock and disorientation, my family tried to fill the void that had been created by giving me someone else to call mommy, by restoring a mother in name to our family unit. And I said, no, no. My mother had existed. She couldn't just vanish one night and be replaced the next morning. I knew what I needed in the immediate aftermath of my mother's death. I made a choice to acknowledge my loss. Soon after I moved in with my grandmother, pictures of my mom disappeared. My dad went back to work, got his own place, eventually started dating again. Years later, it was my 13-year-old cousin who told me that my mom had actually died in a car accident. She hadn't died in the sick bed, I'd imagined, a thermometer hanging off her lips like a cigarette. That night, as I was in the backseat of my grandmother's car, I was glaring at her brown eyes in the rearview mirror. I mean, why had this been a secret? What else didn't I know about? Grief literature talks about the importance of telling the truth about death, especially to children. Approximately 4% of kids between the age of 5 and 16 have lost a parent or a sibling. And in the United States alone, that number is in the millions. Starting the morning after my mom died, and for years after, I wasn't able to confront the real reason she was gone. And when I finally realized what happened, you know, I was confused and angry about these barriers that had been imposed. And as I had before, I said no to them. No. No. Time and time again, when I was a teenager and a young adult, I made public declarations about my longing for connection around my mom's death. When I was 16, I was in a play, and I played a character named Claire, whose mother and father had been killed in a car accident. And I sang a solo called "What Is It Like to Be Dead?" When I was in college, I wrote a 25-page personal essay called My Silence Aching. Yeah, that's what it was called. And I presented it to my father and my grandmother. I mean, I was out there with my grief. I wanted my classmates, family, friends, teachers to bear witness to my story. I was compelled, and I clearly still am, to talk out loud about what had happened and how I felt. My father, in his silence, was on the opposite end of the spectrum. He left the theater before my curtain call when I was 16. And he and I never talked about what I wrote in my 25-page paper. He was alone, in his head, retreating from me. Now, grief is complicated, and I know it looks different for different people. But grief experts say that individuals who mourn in silence often isolate themselves and deny that anything is wrong, and sometimes suffer quietly from feelings of shame or guilt. My father mourned in silence, and I watched what repressed grief did to him. I mean, he became an alcoholic, always nursing a beer when I was with them. You know, he was part of the New Orleans scene, where alcohol really is a part of daily life for a lot of people. He functioned in that place for years, numbing himself a little every day. Eventually, he started taking pills. I mean, grief takes up a lot of space in the body and the mind. And for those who don't deal with it, loss can become intolerable rather than simply painful. And that can lead to self-destructive behaviors. You know, over time, my dad descended into more serious substance abuse, standing in methadone lines with a friend who actually overdosed and died after one of their trips to a clinic. Drinking orange juice and vodkas every morning just to get out of bed. You know, he eventually lost his job and exhausted his 401k to pay his mortgage and lived briefly in his house with no electricity and a foreclosure notice plastered on the front door. In 2011, he came to my city, New York City, for rehab. But within 5 weeks, had checked himself out and was drinking again. I actually bought him a ticket for a Chinatown bus headed south out of New York City after we fought one night. You know, I said, "You can't stay in my house and lie to me." He pleaded, "Please, please, just let me live my life." Only once did I push my dad on the silence. In a difficult email that I wrote to him, I alluded to the 30-plus years of silence between us and my failed efforts to get him to talk to me. He responded in an email. "I was in the car and held your mother when she died. Why don't you get it? This has been with me every day since. I can't ever forget it. I can't keep reliving this over and over, sweetheart. It's too painful. Imagine me pulling her through the window and watching her die." Three years ago, even before my third daughter was born, I was sitting with my girls at the kitchen table on a summer night, and the kitchen window was open, letting in the thick, humid air that always reminds me of New Orleans. I was asking my girls about their fun-filled day that they'd spent with their aunt, my devoted sister-in-law. I think they'd gone to the trampoline park, and they'd had lunch at an Italian restaurant, and they had customized candy bags at Dylan's Candy Shop. Oh my gosh, they were giggling and giggling as they told me the details, and we were all smiling so widely. At one point, my four-year-old, who was slow chewing her chicken, feeling perfect exhaustion, contemplated the adventures that awaited her the next day with her aunt. And she threw her head back, and she sighed. "I wish Lily was our mommy." I froze. My wide smile went away. I mean, I didn't know what to do or say. And as the lump in my throat got bigger and bigger, I stood up from the table. I left my girls alone in the kitchen. I walked down the hallway, and I locked myself in the bathroom. I sat on the toilet, and the tears just exploded from my eyes. And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. I mean, she didn't mean it. I know she didn't mean it. But the cries, I mean, they kept coming. Minutes later, I heard footsteps down the hallway. And I opened the bathroom door just a crack and saw my oldest daughter standing there just a few feet away. She motioned her little sister a few steps behind her to follow her. I'm sorry, I said. But you know, I lost my mom when I was a kid. And my biggest fear is that I'll die prematurely and that I'm replaceable. I mean, I was crying really hard. I couldn't say anything more, and my daughters walked up to me, and they put their arms around my neck, and my oldest girl, who was just 7, said, Mommy, no one can replace you. Minutes later, we were seated on the living room sofa. And, you know, we talked a lot about my mom's death. I talked to them about how I longed my whole life for my mom, and how I wished that my dad and I could talk about her. I wanted them to understand why such an innocent comment from a 4-year-old, so innocent, could have triggered such an intense emotional reaction. And most importantly, I wanted them to understand that it is okay to be in pain. I thought a lot about what my grandmother had said so long ago. You can call me Mommy now. My mother was not replaceable. With my girls in my arms, I knew that she was a part of their lives too, and that I wasn't replaceable either. In June 2013, my dad's neighbors called the police because something didn't smell right. The hazmat team went to his apartment and had to clean up after they removed his body. The medical examiner asked me to send her pictures of my father, and she used his tattoos to definitively identify him. I found out about my dad's death when I was at work, and by the time I got home that night and walked through the front door of my apartment, my girls ran to me. They climbed on my body. They put their hands on my body. I said, Papa died. What happened? They asked. He drank too much alcohol. He became really sick, and his body stopped working. I once read that the great healer of our grief is validation, not time. All grief needs to be heard. My grief was not heard the way it needed to be by my father. And his was not heard by me. Within a few weeks after my dad's death, I received an email from Alan Champagne, an old friend of my dad's with whom I'd connected at the service. Alan called his email Details. And this is what he wrote. I remember looking out my window toward my right, and I saw a car ahead on a side road approaching a stop sign. As I was watching the car, I assumed Margie was too, because all of a sudden the car did not stop for the stop sign, but accelerated onto the highway. Just as I saw it, Steve saw it, and Margie yelled, "Watch out!" The next thing was our car started to roll over, side to side from the impact at least 2 times. Then we landed, right side up, in a swampy area, well off the highway. And then I heard Steve yelling, Margie. Margie was partially ejected from the car. Her waist was on the door sill with her upper body out of the car and her lower body inside it. Steve pulled her into the car and held her tight, calling her name over and over. Her face was undamaged. She was still beautiful. I told Steve we had to get him out of the car. He would not listen to me. He just kept calling out to Margie. Why don't you get it? My dad had written to me in 2011, 2 years before he died, 2 years before I received this email from Alan Champagne. When I read this email, I was in my apartment in New York City with dinner simmering on the stovetop, my daughters nearby, a collage I had created of pictures of my mother, my father, and me before everything changed in 1981, propped up on a coffee table in the living room. With Alan's help, I got it. I got my dad suffering like I never had before because Alan enabled me to bear witness to his story. And I got that my dad's silent, repressed grief was as punishing as it was, probably because he thought he deserved punishment. You know, I wonder if we had really talked to each other, if we had shared our grief, would he have survived? My dad's life ended too soon. But mine will go on. Because I made a choice to confront my grief and tell the truth to myself, my family, and everyone who will listen. Thank you for listening.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. How are you guys doing, ladies and gentlemen? We are in grief counseling where we are dealing with grief today. We are understanding the dynamics of grief and we are hearing from other people's stories what exactly grief is to them and how can we get out of it or how can we live with our grief? So ladies and gentlemen, like I said, many of us, there are some people that grieve differently, right? Yeah, those that grieve in silence, those that, like me, grieve very, very loud. And there are those that dare not discuss.
So I've been a middle school teacher for 19 years, a proud mother for 25, and for 20 years, I was married to the love of my life, my best friend, and my soulmate, Troy Shuler. On March 21st, 2018, Troy Shuler, former Coeur d'Alene High School principal, unexpectedly committed suicide. Today I'm here to share his story. I'm going to take you back to March 20th of 2018. Troy called me on his way home from school, just like he always did, and I remember saying, "Hey, you're calling me a little bit later than normal." He said, "Yeah, I had a meeting at the district office." And I said, "Did everything go okay?" And he said, "Yeah, it was fine." I said, "Are you sure? You hesitated." And he said, "Yeah, it was okay." Being the wife of an administrator for several years, I had learned that there were days that Troy wanted to talk at length about what had happened at school, and there were days when he came home where he wanted to talk about anything but school. So at this point in time, I decided to let it go and wait and see what the mood was like once I got.
All righty.
Got home that night. By the time I got there, he had cooked dinner, he'd opened a bottle of wine. It actually kind of felt like a celebration, and we were celebrating because in a couple of days, we would be on spring break, and we had a family trip planned to Hawaii. We went to bed, and I remember waking up at midnight that night to Troy coming into our room. And I remember saying, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I just can't sleep." Sleepless nights weren't uncommon for either one of us being in education for several years, so I didn't think too much of it. I decided to go sleep in the spare bedroom, though, because I didn't want to keep him up tossing and turning. When I came back in at 5 o'clock in the morning, Troy was wide awake watching TV.
Good evening.
Well, good evening. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, I hope the program is not right.
Really? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
I was thinking this.
Why? Why did you think that? Why? Why did you think that?
You are taking long.
Really? To answer your call? Taking long to answer your call?
So you want to tell us that we must be not mammaring or what?
No. I'm not saying anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just asking, how do you deal with grief? How did you deal with grief? Have you ever experienced grief?
Yeah.
What happened?
But it's very difficult to
what happened? It. Tell me about what happened. I don't want to jump to the...
I loved the loved one.
Okay. You lost whom?
My loved one.
Who's your loved one?
My auntie.
Okay. What happened?
I start falling tears.
You did what?
What I'm saying, eh?
Mm-hmm.
It was very grieving too much. And it was an indication of the healing process for me.
What happened to your aunt? What happened to your aunt?
The auntie died.
Of what?
Of coronavirus.
Mm-hmm. When?
It was 2022.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out? Run us through it.
No, according to the doctor report.
Okay, but run us through it. Obviously, you guys as a family, you guys have more details. So run us through it. This is exactly what we are talking about. Tonight we're talking about the fact that we find it very uncomfortable to talk about people that have passed away. And even in a time where we are asked, right, to talk about it, we are incapable of talking about it. But the question is why? Didn't you love your aunt?
Yeah, I love her.
Doesn't she deserve to be spoken? Doesn't she deserve to be spoken about?
Yes, she deserves to be spoken.
Then why aren't you speaking about her?
This is she was the one who was close to my heart.
Okay, then tell us about that relationship.
Oh, that is my auntie that she was used to took care of me.
Is she from your mother's side, from your father's side?
From my mother's side.
Okay, so she was your mother's sister?
Yeah, from my maternity, yeah.
So she was your mother's sister?
Yeah, my mother's sister, yeah.
Okay, was she the youngest, oldest, which one?
Youngest.
The youngest. How old was she?
It was in her 40, mm-hmm. 47.
Mm-hmm. So she's like your small auntie.
Yeah, my small aunt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what type of person was she?
She was very caring. She was a nurturing person.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what did you love most about her?
She was very supportive. She took care of me, she raised me, she guided me, she advised me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you miss her?
She has all the qualities that possess for a woman to be a good leader.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss her?
She was a woman which I was looking up to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I miss her.
You miss her?
Very too much.
What do you miss most?
Just her presence.
Mm-hmm. So she used to visit you a lot?
Yeah.
Really? Is that true?
You mean now or what?
How? How can she visit you now if she passed away in 2022?
Oh, maybe the spirit or what?
Does she visit you in the spirit?
No.
Oh. So no one visits you in the spirit?
Yeah, she's becoming a sister now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Okay. So she passed away. I know. Yeah. So she passed away from COVID.
Yeah, from COVID. Oh, COVID was humbling us, man.
Tell us about that day.
Hmm?
Tell us about that day.
It was a sad, it was a very sad news. It was a dark side of my day.
What day was it? How? Tell us about the day. So it was a Saturday afternoon, and then my mother called me, and then tell us, run us through it.
So she was staying in Windhoek, and she was hospitalized in Katutura.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she spent there for a few days. Mm-hmm. Also, suddenly we hear bad news that she passed on.
Was she buried in the north?
Yeah, she was buried in the north, and the process of burying it was very cumbersome. Because is a time whereby people were requested to pay some money to those undertakers. Okay. And the money, remember during COVID-19, the resources were very scarce.
What money was being paid to the undertakers?
What if one to be buried, you have to pay 8K.
If the person passed away of COVID?
The person passed away of COVID.
But weren't they state funerals?
Eh?
Weren't they supposed to be state? Or was the state part only for the first part?
Yeah, for the first cases.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay, so you guys paid the funeral home 8,000?
Yeah, for her to receive her homage, yeah. For her to receive her dignified burials. It was very hard, man, it was very hard, very, very, very hard to comprehend it. Oh, but those moments are not good moments.
Okay. What was the funniest thing that you guys have ever done together?
There were a lot.
Like what?
How can I put it now? She used to call me. We used to mock each other in a positive way. Yeah, we used to call names, all sorts of names. Oh, I really miss her a lot. We live in the world that we don't have a guarantee for tomorrow. We must always be grateful, and because waking up each and every day is a grace. Because tomorrow is not a guarantee.
Okay.
This devil is taking us, man.
Is it the devil?
Yeah, it's a devil.
Really?
Yeah, God was not.
Because God promised us eternal life here on earth. How, guys? Why do you guys give the devil so much credit? Because God promised us that we will live forever here in earth.
Death not make a premature death.
But don't we feel like every death is premature?
Yeah. Because they say that the life expectancy of the person is 70. In this world, most.
Yeah, but everybody's destiny is written.
To live 70 years.
But everybody's destiny is written.
Yeah, it's written, yeah.
And everybody has their time. And
yeah,
their
you cannot, yeah, sometimes you cannot dispute the God's plan. Push them black like it was. Which, yeah, the person fight a good fight.
Mm-hmm.
He fought a good fight.
Mm-hmm.
That is their journey.
Okay.
Okay, how do you handle it?
Grief. I just go through it. That's all.
As I'm talking to you now.
I just go through it. I don't have a solid blueprint on how it's supposed to be done. I just, if I'm feeling it, then I'm feeling it. If I'm in it, then I'm in it. I don't really run from it or hide from it. If I'm having an off day, I'm just having an off day.
That's why.
But with me, it's like, if I'm feeling bad, I wake up in the morning and I'm feeling bad and I'm thinking about, someone that passed away.
I thought you are very resilient.
No, I am resilient, and that is that's a sign of resilience, because then I will not go and crash and burn later. Because I allowed myself to feel whatever I was feeling, and I embraced the fact that I'm feeling this way. And that's it. So, fairly. If I wake up in the middle of the morning and I don't feel well and I just feel sad and I feel some type of way, then I'll just stay in bed. How case?
Yeah, we cannot normalize it. Yes, but I would just really kill almost.
Yeah, I'll just stay in bed, guys. I'll just stay in bed and I'll just go into my emotions, and then when I feel better, I get up. If I need to cry, I cry. If I don't...
I will bounce back, yeah.
I don't bounce back. I just get up when I'm done being down. Just bouncing back. When I'm done, I'm done. Okay. All right. I think I feel better now. So, but what I don't do is hide it. I don't say, I'm just going to go.
Most of people, they always suffer. Dying of silent most. Yeah, but they don't want to express their emotions. Which is a bad part of it.
But I don't think you know how to. I think that's the real problem here. That we don't know how to actually express our emotions.
Yeah, because you...
Because even now I asked you very basic questions that are not complicated, but it was difficult for you to answer. Because I'm guessing that was the first time that anybody has ever asked you those questions. And you're like, yo, okay.
We are not comfortable to face that reality.
Why?
You cannot normalize death. It will never be a good news.
Okay.
So you have to just accept that anguish. It's not that easy.
Really? Okay.
You always to make someone traumatized.
Really?
Yeah.
How can we say that it's traumatic to talk about somebody that used to be here? But that's exactly what we are discussing today, that it's not necessarily traumatic.
But we know healing always take time.
Does it?
Yeah.
Who said so? Who said healing takes time?
You put the wounds, they always take time to recover. Because the person is no more.
Okay. So when are you going to get over your aunt?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know?
Only God knows.
Mm.
Okay.
Check the air.
No, I mean the frequency, man.
Check the frequency air.
The air, oh, the frequency air. No, I mean the conventional radio.
Oh. I don't know.
The technician, but the young one.
I don't know.
I'm on the outflow. The minute, Grabman. Yeah, the minute.
We're fighting battles, my friend.
I still believe in you guys.
You cannot not believe in us.
I believe you.
You cannot not believe in us. But also, just keep up with the app.
I know I'm fine with the app.
Oh, then you are asking for others.
Just repeat it for the others.
Oh, for the others that are not getting an opportunity.
We live in the society of Ubuntu. We are always impressed that the principle of Ubuntu.
You and who?
Hmm?
You and who?
The fellow Namibian that used to. That's why part of the reason why you only experiencing few colors.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, okay. How come you don't call every day you that has the app?
Eh?
How come you don't call every day you that has the app?
I have only made data from my mess. There are always some technical glitches.
Oh.
Network I can go.
Oh.
Mm.
You're not sure.
I am a legal at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
I'm a regular listener.
Okay. Must be nice.
I'm a beginning one, which are the beauty of the app. Even if you are in Europe, you can listen.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to be international. Mm. We are international, almost.
But the genius is a the moment the only my Israel on Jingwa Airport, I figure out by Irinalemos.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to make it easy for you. You want to facilitate the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a talk radio.
It's a talk radio station, my friend. Alrighty.
But you guys, you don't recruit to meet your cafe, I can see.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You are all lock staff employees.
We're all just within our borders.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's excelling. Everybody's America in their own house. Everybody. Natango is just a rock star.
Yeah, he's a rock, so he's always hit the ground running.
Oh, okay. That's wonderful.
I'm waiting. I'm strong and better, man.
Nay.
Nay.
We look at competence. We look at everything. My dear, we look at everything.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, nishwe tere la 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 kuchata.
Shashina kukara? How do you think we're alive for 6 years? Literally, we only have 4 more years and then it's a decade.
Oh,
then it's a decade. 4 more years, then it's a decade here. So we are good. We keep it moving.
This is the best of the best.
It has to be.
You guys are a world class.
World. Yes.
World.
It's a world class.
Yeah. World class, yeah.
Yes, of course. Ewane, let's finish with our... But are you listening? Are you listening?
Yeah, I'm going to listen, yeah.
You didn't listen previously?
Yeah, I just listened for a few minutes.
Why? I thought you were a rock star.
I was in the car, man.
You have a new girlfriend?
No.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Why are you taking so long? Why are you taking so long?
Ah, you guys, you come right, mom.
Mm-hmm.
Bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
In this economy.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot keep that. Eh? Every relationship is transactional.
Really? So you are just prostitutes in your relationship. Okay. It's prostitution, that one. If you guys are doing transactions, it's prostitution, but it's fine. Maybe you just like those things. It's fine. It's okay. It's okay. No judgment. I'm not judging you. It's okay.
Love itself does not
feed. It's okay. It's okay.
No more. Love
does not feed anybody, but it's fine. It's fine. I understand what you are saying.
The reality.
Eh, what? Okay. I hope you find a millionaire. I hope you find a millionaire. I hope so, my dear.
A man is always, we have to play the man roles.
Oh, okay. That's why you guys are doing so badly, because you people tell yourself things like that. Those gender roles were only applicable to your fathers and your grandfathers. You people are not supposed to be like that. You people are supposed to be living in a community where you are coexisting with the female. You are not the provider for the female. You are coexisting with the female, because the females are different and the males are different. The problem is that you want to be abusing people's children. And that's why you want to abuse people's children. People's children, they don't want to be abused by you. Sorry. No idea. No, it's like that. That's why you guys miss olden times where women were apparently submissive.
You guys
like that one, but the thing is that men were also real providers. Men were so real
now,
men.
Now there are no more lady providers.
No.
What is...
No. This contemporary times doesn't allow that. There's a 1% of men in this country that are able to be providers, that are able to have housewives, that are able to have women that are not doing anything. All they are doing is shopping and watching TV and taking care of the kids in the house. There's 1% of that. The rest of us, 99%, the rest of us, each and every relationship requires two incomes.
you don't want a female that has
an income of some sort, because then that income also comes with, I'm tired. It comes with financial responsibility. It comes with taking care of other things except you. Right? So now then you go to the woman that has nothing. The woman that has nothing also doesn't have omahangwe, no? Also, she has nothing, and then she has also nothing in the brain. So at the end of the day, she's using you, she's eating your money, and she's also unfaithful to you, and she's chopping them left, right, and center. And then you are angry because apparently you did everything in your life to be a good provider. But in contemporary times, that is not the dynamics of a genuine relationship. The dynamics of a genuine relationship is two people coming together as one.
Two people coming with things.
It's either you come with skills, you come with patience, you come with money, or you come with this, or you come with that. Now, what you guys don't want from the chicks that are working, right, is the fact that they make more money. No, they make more money than you.
They make more money than you.
And even if they don't make more, their lives look so much better than yours. You assume that they make more money than you.
No, I don't want to live a miserable life.
It's not like, okay, but you, your girl that has nothing in the brain, she's cheating on you and she's sleeping with other people, then what?
This is more, I won't cut him.
Oh, in that, like, I am gonna talk to Furaku. You can have that one. You can have the one that is not gonna make you miserable. She might not, she might bring you joy and she might also bring you AIDS at the same time. It's fine. A little bit of joy, a little bit of AIDS over here. It's all good. You know, high blood pressure.
I already see you married in Onemeka. It's become endemic now. Everybody know, is aware about it.
To be honest, if you start, sleeping with somebody and if you start sleeping with somebody and this person is unfaithful to you, right? You'll get the virus. I promise.
Yeah, you contract the virus.
Yeah. Even if you are telling me nonsense like, yeah, AIDS is not what it used to be. You will not just contract it like that. That is only for people that are sleeping with multiple people. It's only for them, not for you that is faithful to somebody that's unfaithful. That's the only people that are not getting AIDS are the people that know that I'm only having sex with this person this one time and then I go to the clinic and then I go and get medication. I'm not sleeping with them every day. Now you, when you are sleeping with them for a whole year every day, you'll get it. You will get it no matter how smart you think you are, because you cannot also be taking PrEP the whole time. Okay, for how long? For years.
Then you go get. Then you go replenish again.
So they are encouraging us to not use condoms.
Yeah.
With strangers that are unfaithful to us. Hey, an STD? Other STDs?
They are all shielded.
They are shielded under this one injection that doesn't have a name. Is it here already in Namibia?
No idea.
It's not here. It's not here. So you guys will just perish like that.
Hmm?
You just perish like that. The truth is that the longer you are in a relationship with someone, the longer you are in a relationship with someone, the more likely it is that you stop using protection. The longer. When they just start wearing same color clothes, you know that these people are not using condoms anymore.
So you become negligent.
You will contract it. Do you know how difficult it is to tell somebody that, oh, listen, baby, I sleep with other people, ne? So you must be careful of me. Yeah? Can you imagine? Hey, baby. Oh, I just wanted to tell you that I'm very unfaithful, man, and I sleep around. So please use a condom with me, my love. Hey. Yeah? Yeah, ne? You know, we are fighting very hard, ne, for a thing that might be over tomorrow. Private wealth client.
Yeah.
He didn't pay, so we have to. Not unless you as a family can pay off. If you have,
life cover, those are luxury.
Ne, you must just wing it. Must just drink water and be healthy. Hope you're not gonna die anytime soon, ne?
Yeah.
No, life cover is security for your children, man. It's not a luxury. It's a necessity. Yeah, so that you can leave your children something. Do you know how bad it is to be broke and also to be an orphan? Oh, yes.
Oh,
at least be, have money and be an orphan.
That is poverty dimension.
Yeah, at least don't have the mongaka flat, okay? So you can go and cry in your flat. You're not crying at auntie's house in the village, you know?
Super broke.
Yeah, super broke. So I know.
You guys also don't like the broke niggas most.
No, the problem with the broke niggas, is, check, the problem with the broke niggas, is that they make it seem like their situation is your fault.
Yeah.
It's your fault that I'm poor, It's so not my fault.
So you are not responsible for his suffering.
There was this couple that was going, trending on social media. They were breaking up because the girl is working in a salon. And the guy is looking for a job. And the girl is just tired of the guy now. She's like, I don't want anymore. I'm done. And when he's writing a text.
What was it?
No, he wasn't a parasite.
Yeah,
also
parasita.
Parasita. No, he wasn't a parasite. No, he wasn't a parasite. It's just that he landed on hard times. She was also tired of his writing because, you know, the way he texts, he doesn't put commas. So he just writes one long paragraph with no commas and no full stops. So she was frustrated about that. And her argument was that it's been 5 years.
By
looking at a job. No, you are looking for a job for 5 years.
Mm.
I don't believe that you can stay unemployed for 5 years.
Well, you don't believe it, huh?
No.
No.
I don't believe it. I believe that you can stay unemployed for 5 years if you are picky about employment.
People are selective.
Yeah, that's the reason that you are unemployed for 5 years. It's not because there's no employment. It's because you are picky about the employment that's there. Yeah, that's the problem. The problem here is that you don't care about anybody else but yourself because you would rather be unemployed and asking your girlfriend for money, ne? Than going to work at the service station.
I was going to create a dependent syndrome.
Yeah, and then you become comfortable with being sent cosmetics money. I don't believe that you can stay unemployed for 5 years.
Yeah, but
no.
Maybe you don't have a network, huh?
No. Look, you can go to Andangwa and you can go and ask for service station people and you give them their numbers. Kucha, if you're looking for somebody, I'm willing to come and work. As a petrol jockey, as a cleaner, as what, there are many jobs. The problem is that we think that some jobs are beneath us.
Yeah.
Yes. And if we look at the jobs that we think are beneath us, right? We can look at we can really honestly have things that we'll never do. Like I don't see myself as a cashier.
Yeah.
Like a cashier, Hello, ma'am. How are you? Tick, tick, tick. I can't. I can't visualize that. I think
I the good part of you, your voice is your invoice.
Well, thank God for people that notice that. Yeah, but that is just one thing that I can't picture it. I think it's too many hours, it's too many people, it's too redundant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's I can't. But I can see myself as a waiter. As a server. Yeah. I can see myself as a waiter. I can see myself as a cook. I can see myself as a cleaner. I think the only thing that I can't is that one. Everything else I can. If push comes to shove, I'll even send Tatewalenga a letter. Kucha, I know me, I also want to be the cleaner. I want to be the radio presenter at night, and in the daytime I'm cleaning. It is what it is. I don't have a problem.
So how's your business?
My business is going well.
You are not affected by corona.
No. I opened in the time of corona.
Oh.
Yeah, I opened in 2021.
Oh, you fired employees, so I happy.
No, I fired many employees. I'm on my 10th employees. I'm in my 10th set. Not even. I'm a tall girl. I'm not short. I'm not tiny. No. It's because I laugh too much. It's because I don't have boundaries, Mos.
Between you and Zuzu, who's the tallest?
Between me and who? Who is Zuzu?
Yeah.
Who is Zuzu?
Happy.
Oh, that's not Zuzu, man. It's Juju. Juju. Okay, I'm taller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm taller.
Oh.
I'm a tall girl.
I'm a tall girl.
I think that it is the laughing and the understanding, it's the laughing and the understanding and the also oversharing. You know, when people know your trials and tribulations.
The other day you are oversharing.
Yeah. So people think that you cannot fire them because they know your secrets. It's like, go with them, my dear. It's fine. I'll just go and also talk about it. I'm like, dog, whatever you're going to say now, it's not like I didn't tell over a million people. There's nothing new under the sun for me.
No.
So I think that's the problem. But now with my current girls, I'm with them for, happy it's 3 years, Monia it's,
3 years,
three, four, yeah, and then there's also a two new ones. There was one, there was one that was cleaning for us, when was it, last year, but she was also studying, she was doing media studies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and she was in her final year, so she needed to do an internship. So, Dina is working. Dina is a working hand now.
Okay,
my dear employees. That's your salary this month, huh? That's your quarter, Mama Avari.
From your wisdom, it seems like they are doing better.
My children, huh? My children are doing wonderfully. They have their trials and tribulations, man, but they have good heads on their shoulders. Yeah. But they have good heads on their shoulders, and for that I'm proud of them.
Me?
I'm proud of them. Yeah, I've got graduates, guys. Like, graduates. Mia is a graduate also. Like, and she's working as well. She's working. Aina is doing her internship. She's a nurse.
Oh,
okay. My dear, happy is working.
Wayne
is in varsity, so he should be second year now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody's fine, guys. And did man of Kujara or Shiki or graduation? And Dina wanted a camera for her graduation. I got her a camera.
Uh-huh.
Mm, so now she must be taking killer shots when she gets her battery.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Ciao, ciao.
I now realize, looking back, he probably had been awake all night planning his last day. We both went about our regular morning routine. On most days, Troy was in a big hurry to get out of the door. He was always the first one through the doors of the school, usually there by 5:30 in the morning, hoping to get in an hour of peace and quiet before the craziness of his day began. And so usually he was in a pretty big rush to get out of the door. But I remember this morning when he left, I remember when he hugged me, he held me tight. And I remember him pulling away after he kissed me, and he looked me right in the eyes and he said, "I love you." And I remember saying to him, "Wow, that was really nice." And now I realize that was his final goodbye, and that was the last time I saw him alive. On my way to school that morning, I drove by his school parking lot, and I noticed that his vehicle was missing. I called him and said, "Hey, where are you?" And he said, "Oh, I had a meeting at the district office." I remember cracking a joke about, "Oh, I know how much you love meetings." And I said, "Just hang in there. We only have one more day." And I told him I loved him. And that was the last time I heard his voice. Later on that afternoon, our school resource officer showed up in my classroom. And he told me that they had a welfare check for Troy at our house. And I remember going, "What?" At the time, I didn't even know what a welfare check was. He then said, "Is Troy depressed?" And I said, "What are you talking about? No, Troy isn't depressed." Shortly after, the school resource officer showed up from Coeur d'Alene High School with our son. He said that Troy had called him and asked him to bring our son to me, that he had been put on paid administrative leave at his meeting at the district office the night before, and that he was planning to take his own life. I got on my phone and tried to call him, and the phone went right to voicemail. I tried to text him, and instead of it turning blue like it always did, it turned green. Right then and there, I knew I had lost him forever. We were all in shock. None of us saw it coming. It didn't make any sense. Troy was educated and successful. As an administrator, he was known as being driven and hardworking, firm and fair, but he was also known as being kind and compassionate. People sought him out for advice all the time, students, teachers, parents, community members. I used to joke that he should have been a school counselor instead of a school administrator. And Troy was the type of person that would do anything for anybody. He wanted to win over the whole entire world. In addition to that, Troy had a strong support system. We had a loving and committed marriage. We didn't have any financial problems. Both of our children were doing very well, due in large part to the fact that Troy was a hands-on father. And he also had really fantastic friends. As a matter of fact, he talked to two of his best friends that morning, both of them also school administrators, who could have given him some pretty great advice on the situation he was facing. And Troy had resources. As a school administrator, he put people in connection with resources on a daily basis. I knew that somehow I was going to have to put the pieces of this puzzle together. I read after Troy died that actually only a small percentage of people who commit suicide actually leave a note. I knew that Troy wouldn't leave me without some sort of an explanation. So on the day he died, I chose to go home to find the note. When I got there, it wasn't there because the police had confiscated it. But when they brought it to me the next day, two lines really stood out to me. He said, "Ever since January of 2001, I haven't felt right. My body aches continuously, but my headache never goes away. That, along with this alleged complaint, leaves me only one way out." I knew exactly what January 2001 was all about. At the time, my husband had been a high school wrestling coach, and on his way to a high school wrestling tournament, the bus driver had suffered a massive heart attack and had died instantly at the wheel. My husband and another wrestler had ran to the front of the bus to try to keep it from crashing. When the bus crashed into a tree, he sprained his ankle, broke his knee, broke his jaw, and suffered major head trauma. It was so major, in fact, that he remembered the morning of the bus accident, but didn't remember anything again until 6 weeks later when he was at the state wrestling championship. 6 weeks of his memory was completely gone. When he talked about how his body ached continuously, in addition to the two surgeries he went through after the bus accident for his broken knee, when he was in high school, he had been in another major car accident. And at that time had also gone through a major back surgery. In his 20s, he started to experience some pretty severe back pain. So he went to visit a doctor. The doctor told him at that time his only option was to have metal rods put in his back. He would lose range of motion and surely would lead to other surgeries. His suggestion, tough it out for as long as you can. So at that point in time, that's when my husband started to live with chronic pain on a daily basis. In the next part of the letter, when he talked about how he had a headache that never went away, in the year and a half before my husband died, he experienced two more major concussions. The first one was on a day much like today. He went over to plow my sister's driveway out, and he slipped on the ice and smashed his head into the concrete driveway. That following summer, when we were out boating, we had stopped, and he was swinging on a rope swing on a bridge, and when he swung across the lake and flipped into the water, he hit his head at a weird angle. When he talked about how he hadn't felt right, that took a little bit more investigation. My father-in-law actually visited a doctor not long after, and the doctor mentioned something about CTE. And at the time, it really took me back. When I thought of CTE, I thought about the movie Concussion, and I thought about NFL football players. So after doing a little bit of research, I learned that CTE is a degenerative brain disease that slowly attacks the brain cells over time. Symptoms do not generally appear until years later after the initial brain trauma. In people's 20s and 30s, they'll experience control problems, aggression, depression, and paranoia. In their 40s and 50s, cognitive symptoms generally appear. When Trey had said, along with these alleged complaints, I learned after he had died, at that meeting at the district office, he had been accused of breaking the school district's drug policy by taking opioids. And slowly but surely, after he died, people one by one started coming to me with their stories. One of his best friends who told me that he'd been visiting his grandmother, who had caught him taking prescription medication from her bathroom. He had also been visiting an uncle more frequently who also had prescription medication in his home. There were stories from students and staff members who Troy had visited after they had had surgeries, who also said that prescription medication had disappeared after he had been there. Even our own son and daughter came to me with stories about Dad taking prescription medication, and he had said, "Hey, don't tell Mom." I quickly realized that Troy had turned to opioids as a way to try to deal with his chronic pain and his headaches, so he could continue to do his job as a principal, and so he could continue to take care of his family. In another part of his final letter, Troy had said, "I never wanted to let you down." I realized that the last thing that had killed him was his own pride. See, we had grown up in a small town where our heroes were loggers and mill workers and truck drivers. These were men with a tremendous work ethic, tough men who toughed it out no matter what, and you never complained. I also knew that Trey's good name meant the world to him. I quickly realized that it literally killed Troy to think about asking for help. So at this point in time, I knew how and why he had died, but I didn't know how I was going to go on without him. The best word I can use to describe what I went through is devastation. And for a year and a half, I didn't live, I survived. The only thing that forced me to get out of bed every morning was knowing that if I didn't get up and try to at least pretend like I was okay, was that my own two children wouldn't have been able to go on. The worst part is living with the guilt. I couldn't figure out how I didn't know what was happening. I was supposed to be Trey's person. Why hadn't he come to me for help? So after a year and a half of living this way, the only way I could get through was to build up a wall around myself to try to protect myself. I could talk about Troy and tell stories about him all day and talk about the type of person he was, but to try to talk about what had happened forced me to break down every time. I realized I couldn't go on like this anymore. My counselor had said, well, maybe since you can't talk about it, maybe you should write about it. So one day, out of desperation, I sat down and I wrote. And at the end of 6.5 hours, I had a pretty powerful story that I thought maybe could help others. But what I really realized is there are 4 things in our society that have to change. 1, we have to continue research on concussions and CTE. There's no way for me to know for sure that Troy had CTE. By the time I suspected it, it was too late. Troy had requested to be cremated. But I really believe in my heart that that's why Troy hadn't felt right for so many years. The second thing we have to do is we need to begin research to find new ways to help people that are dealing with chronic pain. I believe that opioids serve a purpose in the short term. Somebody who's undergone surgery, that's going to be better in a couple of weeks. But for somebody like my husband who was dealing with chronic pain for several years, opioid use leads to addiction because after time, the pain-relieving effects lessen and the pain actually increases. Dependence leads to painful withdrawal symptoms, making it very difficult to stop. We have to give our doctors other options to help patients that are dealing with pain on a day-to-day basis, year after year after year. The next thing I would like to see changed are our privacy laws. I went to see the school administrator who had put Trey on administrative leave to find out about that final meeting. And I remember on my way out of the door, her saying to me, I wish I could have called you, but because of privacy laws, I couldn't. I understand the need for privacy laws. I wouldn't want my employer to be able to share my personal information with the public, but I would like to change them so that people can volunteer to appoint somebody on their behalf, somebody that could be contacted if their employer has any concerns about them for any reason. I know that if Troy and I would have had this option, we would have appointed each other, and I honestly believe if I would have gotten a phone call that night, he would still be with me today. The 4th thing that we've got to change in our society is we need to spend more money on mental health. People cannot be kept from the counseling that they need because of lack of money or because of lack of insurance. And we have got to open up more mental health facilities for people in our cities and towns. So I decided to share my story with my own 2 children and a close group of friends. And they all felt like the story was very powerful and that it could help other people dealing with the same issues. And they also thought that hopefully by sharing this story, that these 4 issues could be addressed in our society. So we created a webpage called TroyStory.com, and we shared it through a social media campaign, kind of a pay it forward challenge. We asked people that once they read the story to please share it with 5 more people. People described Troy's story as being raw and brutally honest. And I quickly realized that that must be what we need because within 48 hours, 85,000 people in over 50 states had visited the site. Troy's story suddenly had a new purpose. I realized that by sharing Troy's story, it was breaking the silence and removing the stigma around concussions, CTE, opioid addiction, mental health, and suicide. It was opening up the door to important conversations. People were talking about Troy's story in their church groups. Teachers were talking about it in their classrooms with their students. College professors added it to their curriculum. People started sharing their own stories on social media. And my favorite stories were tough, well-respected men who came to me and said, I've never talked about these issues until I read Troy's story. And one good friend came to me and told a story of how by sharing Troy's story, we had actually saved somebody else's life. What I learned after a year and a half about not being able to talk about this is that you have to be strong to ask for help. Troy didn't ask for help because he didn't want people to know that he was weak. So I'm hoping that if we really, truly, openly, and honestly start talking about these issues, that our culture will change so that when people are weak, they won't be afraid to ask for help. So in conclusion, yes, my husband died by suicide. But I also believe he slowly died over the years by the events that unraveled from a bus accident in January of 2001. And when I look back, I try to be grateful. I'm grateful because if he would have died that day, our son, who I was pregnant with at the time, would have never known his dad. He would have never given our daughter away at her wedding or given her her high school diploma. He would have never held our two grandchildren. And I would have never experienced the wonderful, loving marriage that I did, that some people live their whole lives and never experience. Would I do it all again, knowing how it ends? The answer is yes. But I don't want anybody else's story to end the way that ours did. And I don't want any other family to endure what our family has. So I'm asking you to please talk about this openly and honestly. I understand that it's uncomfortable at first, but I have learned that people have to be uncomfortable for change to occur. And these issues have to change. I know from firsthand experience that lives are depending on it. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Me, the matriarch, I'm signing out on this very emotional Thursday morning. I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day. And I'll see you again on the flip side. That is tomorrow. And I'm starting early. So, hello, hello. How are you?